you, attendees, and welcome to our web briefing this morning called More Profitable Relationships Faster, where in about 50 minutes, our guest speaker, Nick Miller, will help you understand what is necessary in today's contracting economy. I guess there's argument about that now, to hold on to your key customers and attract new ones. My name is John Hoskins, and I'm the co-founder of Advantage Performance Group, and I will be your host and your MC for today's webinar. Now, today's event is part of a series of sessions that we have conducted at Advantage over the past 10 months, and I'd like to draw your attention to our final session, which is scheduled December 2nd, where Alan Fine, the founder of Inside Out Development, will share his expertise on sales coaching. That's a topic I think that's near and dear to all of our hearts. So please mark your calendars, and for that future event, if you want to register, you can go to our website at www.advantageperformance.com, and you'll be able to get registered for that December 2nd session. But before I introduce today's presenter in greater depth, let me just cover some housekeeping details. In order to eliminate the background noise during the presentation, we're going to mute the line, and as time permits, we will open the phones to question and answers at the end of the presentation so you have a chance to interact with our speaker today. The second item with regard to note-taking, you need not be concerned with taking notes of the information on the slides, as we are happy to make those available to you through your Advantage partner in charge of your account. And then finally, we will also provide you some instructions at the end of the briefing for a more in-depth set of information about Nick's presentation, or perhaps something company-specific about your own sales environment and sales force. Our speaker this morning is Nick Miller. Nick is the president of Clarity Advantage, similar to Advantage Performance Group. It's a Boston-based consultancy. And I have to say I've had the pleasure of working with Nick and knowing him for nearly 25 years. As much younger men, we co-led a number of sales transformation engagements for major banks in the mid-80s when that industry was trying to adapt to the world of sales and service excellence. Now, Nick's continued his work in that arena and today is considered a preeminent authority on sales at major banks around the world. He's the author of two books on sales, which I do recommend having in your library, one entitled Winning at Prospecting and the other called The Sales Accelerator. But probably most important, if you don't do anything else as a result of today's webinar, I highly encourage you to subscribe to Nick's weekly sales newsletter. It's not only insightful, it's brief, so you can get through it in less than a couple minutes. It's often a laugh out loud, full of humor, and we'll give you the details on how to get that newsletter later, but it's one of the things I do read every Monday morning. So for today's webinar, we'd like to try something a little bit different with you. We're going to ask you to actually try to do some work while you're listening in. So you can't surf the web or write emails while you're participating today. We'd like to actually have you think of an account that you have been pursuing or perhaps somebody in your sales force is pursuing and begin to contemplate the ideas presented in Nick's concepts here as he presents them and see how they might apply to you formulating a little different game plan for that account and how you might approach it differently in the future. So with that, I'll say good day, Nick. Let's dive in. If you're muting the lines, that's the star 7 feature on the conference call. So we'd have background noise eliminated, and we're going to move ahead with your thinking on selling in today's environment. Can you tell us how it's what it's really like out there?
Well, it's challenging. This could represent anybody on the line. It could represent your clients. You know, I think we have been up against the granite wall, and you know, I think everybody is trying to figure out how do I get through this to the other side. And you know, as you're thinking about this, I'm wondering, does this look like any of your customers or anyone in your sales force, perhaps even yourself? The frustration is that the rules are changing. I was sitting in a meeting a week or so ago with a couple of very high, well-known economists, and one of the questions from the floor was, what does the new normal look like? And there are two interesting points to that. One is, that there is an assumption that there will be a new normal, that we're not going back to where we were, and that nobody knows what that looks like, with possible devaluation of the dollar, you know, other things, major rule changes. I think everybody's trying to figure out how do I survive. So it's very tough for businesses that are small as well as businesses that are very large.
Well, I have to agree, Nick. I think the clients that I have are finding that even the top performers are represented in this picture, and of course that has them operating a lot from fear and doubt, a place that none of us like to be, and they're just trying to find kind of a new way to make them think through all of this until, quote-unquote, it blows over like the big storm. Why don't we move ahead to the advice that you have for us to get through this this storm?
Sure. So the first place that we think to start is to think about how are your clients reacting to the environment in which they find themselves. So one possibility is that they're confidently moving forward, they have a plan in place, they feel like they're under control. You know, there are a number of, say, in the professional services sector where the economy is good and there are people who are benefiting from the stimulus money. This is good, so they're moving forward. So not everybody's in a panic, so they might be moving forward. They might be a little on edge, but maintaining an even strain, so they're holding their own. So it's useful to know how are they feeling about it, and then also that you may have some who are throwing the deck chairs and goats over the side, that they're in panic, they're trying to lighten the load, they're laying people off, they're shuttering or doing furloughs, they're closing places down. So you really, as you think about how to position yourself as a salesperson or as a sales manager, how to position your sales force, the question is, where are our clients at this point? Are they throwing the goats overboard, or do they have a plan and they're acquiring and investing? We in particular, for example, have a client that is on a watch list, but they're investing very big money to move forward and take advantage of the opportunities that are in the crisis. So you may have some clients like that as well.
So as our participants are thinking about this account that they have, Nick, are you suggesting that this may help them decide how to spend their time with their accounts, or are you just saying that this is where they are at this point and we need to acknowledge it and not necessarily avoid any one of these categories?
Well, I think you don't know. So this is more about choosing your approach and figuring out what's of value. You know, one of the problems that we see in both financial and non-financial sales forces is that the marketing department or somebody decides this is how we're going to go to market. This is our message. And that's good. It's good that somebody's making that call. But if you're really looking at a more granular level, you have to think about where are my particular clients and what kind of value proposition, what kind of help do they need? And therefore, what kind of value proposition would I approach with? So one point of this slide is just to recognize that people may be in different places. Two is to ask yourself the question, how do I adapt to that and where do I approach? And then the third, by implication, is what should my company be doing to support me in approaching clients who may be in very different spots? You know, if they're throwing the goats over the side, maybe you need to help them throw over the goats. If they're expanding, then you want to come to them with a value proposition around expansion. If they're a little on edge, it's likely to be more around cost control. So that's really what I'm saying here, is you have to figure out where your particular clients are before you know how to help them survive or stay with them and expand your relationship.
Okay, got it. So it's almost that Covey thing of you want to be understood, seek to understand, and here you are understanding where they're coming from. What next?
Well, the next thing is to look at where do we stand with this client at this point. So remembering that the idea here is to build relationships and accelerate relationship development faster. If we're in a downturn or your client's having to take a sharp right or left turn in response to the economy or competition, first, where are they, and then where are we? And so we could be very distant, a vendor. So if we're in that position, we have certain choices that are available to us and other choices that are not. We could be a consultative presence that we're perceived as helpful but not critical to the mission. So an example of that would be that if you are selling you're selling software to different companies, and you have a good consultative relationship. They look to you for counsel on the software, but the issue at the moment is laying off a bunch of people and closing some sites that have nothing to do with your software. They may value the relationship, and if you have something to add to the conversation, they're happy to hear it, but you're not really on the critical path. And then the third level is you're a confidant, close advisor. You're a sounding board. So how we approach depends on what their status is. Are they expanding or throwing the goats overboard? And where we stand, are we distant or are we really close? Because the intersection of those will give us certain choices that are available to some, but not everybody who's calling on them. So ideally, you want to be the closer you are, the better, but you are where you are.
So I'm beginning to see Nick Miller's Excel spreadsheet here with, this is useful thinking. It's a matrix of some sort where there's the client's perspective of where they're at, then there's their perspective of who we are as an organization, or perhaps myself. What else goes into the logic?
Varying from the script just a little bit here, I would say that there's a couple of things. One is, as you're thinking about managing your time as a salesperson, there's another axis in the chart which has to do with access. So do we have easy access or difficult? That's related to being a vendor or a close confidant. Another is value, potential value of the client to us. So you got to be thinking about, where do I want to invest time through this recession or this expansion, whatever we're in, and where do I want to, so where do I want to grow, where do I want to maintain, and where do I happily let some people go? So that's not expressed in these two charts, but as a salesperson, if you're thinking about, is my client shrinking or growing, and am I distant or close, that begins to get you access to, should I be trying to invest in this account to grow it, should I be maintaining what I've got, or should I be looking someplace else?
Got it. Good tool.
So as we think about how to move that conversation forward, there are several elements. I'm just going to cover that are mistakes, really. The next several slides are responses to mistakes that we see salespeople and sales organizations making when we're going through this recession. I'm old enough to have lived through several of them, and these are pretty consistent mistakes. So the first one has to do with goal focus. So every salesperson would say, sure, I've got to understand my client's near-term, intermediate-term, and long-term goals. Very good, gold star. The trick to this is that when you're up to your bottom in alligators, it's easy to forget what was the reason that we were draining the swamp in the first place. And so it's very easy to get sucked into your client's near-term goals and just focus on that with them. So they call up and say, hey, I need this training. Or they call up and say, hey, I got to have X number of widgets at this price or whatever it is. And they're all about the short term. They're going week to week, month to month, maybe quarter to quarter. But they're really focused on near-term, and they're reaching out to their vendors and saying, you know, what can you do to help us? We're fighting for our lives here. So it's very easy for us as salespeople to get trapped there. Purchasing likes that. Our clients will feel well-served. That's where the hot action is. But you have to continue to think about, where is this client? Where did this client say they were going in the first place? We're in the swamp now. We got the alligators. But where were they going? And what could I do right now in this account while I'm helping them fight the fires to be planting seeds, or helping them see seeds they could be planting on their own that will help moving forward? So it's not that you're not going to sit down and say, well, John, let's think about your long-term goals as you're laying a bunch of people off. That's probably not top of mind, but there may be things that I can see as a salesperson that I could raise for you, or I could do some investment and research on my own and begin to put ideas together that would relate to the intermediate or long-term goals, thus positioning us as salespeople for the growth when it turns, and also, frankly, showing that we care and that we're willing to invest in the long-term of the account. you know, buying stock in your clients is another thing that shows confidence. So if you climb into the short-term basket with them only, you're lost, because when they turn, you'll be too late.
It strikes me too, Nick, that I'm not refuting what you say here. It's just it's somewhat 101, and the account may be thinking, look, you know, right now I just want to survive this thing. We got to see our way through this, kind of be ready for the uptick, as you said. Or, you know, maybe that's a comment that a CEO would never make, but not everyone's selling at that level all the time. So it seems the lower you are in the hierarchy of chain of command with your sales process, the more likely you are to have people wanting to think short-term, near-term, as opposed to long-term.
Yeah, I would agree with that, but I don't agree that it's 101. I mean, I think the concept is 101. Actually, understanding and interpreting the signals in the organization that you're working with at this level when they're in crisis is anything but 101. And it takes a lot of understanding of that company that needs to have been built ahead of time, or you do it now, a good ability to read people and empathize and connect. The execution is anything but 101. The concept is pretty simple.
Gotcha. Sort of the common sense is not all too common.
Right.
Okay.
So the understanding of the goals is important to help do the next thing, which is to reframe. So here's an example from our world. Client shows up and says, we're rolling out a new sales position to take advantage of a opportunity that we see in the market, and we want to do a bunch of training and this, that, and the other thing to roll that out. Well, that's a response. That's a strategic, in their view, that's a strategic initiative that they're undertaking. Our view is it's a panic thing, and the way they're doing it just oozes panic. And while they're doing that, they are missing some signs that they ought to be paying attention to that would lead them to change the initiative a little bit, certainly change some of the specifics they're giving their salespeople, and to take other actions that they now see as low priority, but we frankly see as medium to high priority, given what we see competitors doing. And it's that perspective of what's going on in the market that we have, happily, and they have less of. So one of the reasons you want to understand your client's goals is so that you can reflect on the information that you have and convey insights or share some perspective that your client may be missing. That's one of the advantages of calling on a number of different kinds of companies in a particular industry, for example, is you really get a sense of the competitive environment and what's going on and how you see the economy so that you can then lead with ideas. So they may see the world one way. You, because of your perspective, see it another way. They overlap a bit but don't match. So often I've heard salespeople say, well, they're not going to do anything. And that's not true. They won't do it as long as their assumptions don't change or their beliefs don't change. So the trick here is to be able to weave a storyline that helps the client see or interpret the facts that they're getting in a different way. Again, this is 101 concept, but not necessarily easy to do. So the idea of the map here is that you may be able to help them see a bigger picture of where they are, frame that in the context of their goals, and the significance of the guy pointing in the other direction is you really need to go this way as opposed to the way that you were thinking about. Now, again, if you're at a high level, it's easier to do that than if you're selling just simply at the lowest levels of the house where they're being given orders and you are going to therefore be an order taker. So you have limited degrees of freedom at that point. You're deflecting small amounts, where if you're calling higher, you have the ability to deflect a little more broadly. So, John, I'm kind of curious, in the accounts you've called on, where have you seen an example of that?
Well, I'm not. It's sort of, the metaphor really works for me, because I was driving around New England, as you know, last week, and there are many ways to get to different cities in that part of the country. When you pull out the map, you can go point A to point B, or you can take a different route, maybe one that's a little more scenic, or you can take a very direct route that is the interstate highway. So this idea of framing for them your bigger picture of the industry they're in, and then
accounts or boost market share. There are a number of different ways to get there. In the industry I work with most, the typical answer for that is we're going to put more salespeople on the street. Well, because of our knowledge of the competitive environment and what people are doing, we are actually working on ideas with people that say don't put more people on the street. Same number of people, but you need to adjust what you're doing with your call centers. You need to change what you're doing with your online marketing. Don't do the expense route. Do it this way. And the reframing has to do with they see only one path. More sales means more bodies. Our reframe is more sales comes from more contact and more consistent contact. What's the cheapest way to get that? And so we're actually having some success moving a few people toward the call center route that they said, you know, 6 months or a year ago, we're never going that direction. Well, now they're going. And in some cases, it's just largely because we reframed it for them and showed them a different set of math that led to their goals but had them change their beliefs about productivity. So that leads to the next piece, which is value. So there's three levels of value we're going to talk about here. And, you know, I think many salespeople are almost sick to death of hearing, you got to sell value. We're selling solution value here. It's more than that. And particularly when you're in a hot environment and it's not going well, the question is, the clients are saying, you know, what can you bring to the table? And so the first level of value that we think about and that salespeople we encounter are not very good at expressing is their own personal value. We think, and we agree with the research that demonstrates that when clients are looking at a potential vendor relationship, they're asking, who are you, who's your company, and what products do you sell? And it's sort of in that order. And so the idea of expressing personal value is really important here. And I'm going to come back to that, something specific about that in a moment. The same thing is true for company value, and I'll provide a very specific element of that, and it's only then that you get to the value of the solution. So let's talk about personal value for a moment. The question that we ask salespeople is, when you're consulting with or energizing your clients with ideas, what are you talking about? You know, when you really have them engaged and they're taking notes and they're thinking this is a great conversation, what is it that you're actually doing with them? Now, it could be, well, I'm telling them about our products. Well, okay, so what? So, you know, it really raises the question, what outcomes have the clients achieved that were different than they could have expected otherwise because of your experience? So, you know, for example, in the banking space where we work often, if you asked somebody, what are you consulting with your clients about, they would say, well, I'm talking to them about loans, or I'm talking to them about cash management. You know, in the technology community, could be I'm talking to them about hardware, or I'm talking to them about software. Well, that's a product conversation. The question is, so what is it in your experience that really enables you to create value with a client? And if you're thinking about hardware and software, it could be that your experience, what you are able to help clients do differently is think about the way they make decisions or how their hardware and software decisions fit with their strategy. You know, classic mistake is just to buy some equipment and some software and it's disconnected from strategy because it was the IT people who bought it, not the strategy people. And so one of the things that a really experienced salesperson can do is get those two parties to come together more and to influence the way the organization, IT organization, makes its decisions. So it's, you know, I've been in this business for 20 years, great, so what? I've worked with 15 companies like you, great, so what? I've helped them install, you know, 6,000 this's and that's and, you know, 5 different software programs, great, so what? You're boring me, so what? What do you do with that knowledge? What do you do with that experience? What do you actually help your clients do? That is a very hard question for salespeople to answer. We spend hours with salespeople getting them to articulate that for themselves. It's very challenging. And once they get it the first time, it's an ongoing process to refine it. It's a similar sort of thing when you think about the value of your firm. Well, we're valuable because we're in 10 countries. So what? we're valuable because we have representatives in all 50 states. Great. So what? We're valuable because we have an IT group and a service group and a whatever group. Great. So what? I mean, really, so what? I don't care. I'm a client. I don't care. So it's useful to think about the value of the firm across what we call the four Ps, people, products, process, and past experience, and to think, what is it that we bring to the table in each of those? So what that we have the people that we've got? So what that we've got the products that we've got? So what that we have the process that we've got, if we actually have a documented process, but so what that we've got that? Those are the kinds of questions you're trying to answer, and it isn't stuff the marketing department dreams up. They're largely clueless on this, in my experience. This is what salespeople need to do, and the sales organization needs to articulate this for themselves and for their clients. And it's answering the same questions. What outcomes have clients achieved that were different than they could have expected otherwise because of your company's four Ps? Again, not an easy question to answer. Our consultants have a minimum of 20 years experience. So what? What difference has that made to anybody?
Well, Nick, you know, I'm thinking about the three buckets that you started with, which was, you know, the personal value, the company's value, and then this next one you have about the solution value. It's really the first one that the salesperson has the most control over, though. Right? I mean, their own personal expertise and value is the one that they can affect the most.
They affect it because they have the most control over it. It is easier for salespeople to make the translation about the so what for the company's people, products, processes, and past experience than it is about themselves and their own experience. It's just harder for them to think about themselves.
Right.
But an example, I'm going to use a banking example again, but it has general applicability. Every bank has a process for determining to which customers it will lend money. Every company in the world who extends credit to its customers makes the same decision. Can we trust them to pay us? Well, the question is, what value does that process have to your clients? We're going to come back to this in a little bit. Is there a particular way that you make your credit decisions and allocate credit to your clients that's different than what your competitors do that helps your clients get a better result? So, if you put the question to salespeople that way, it's their job to interpret their company to their clients. So they don't have control over these things, but they do have the power to articulate it in a way that resonates with a particular client they're talking to. Just like, moving on to the next one, the value of the offer. You know, there are companies we work with that just have the usual products, their good looks, and not much after that. You know, you ask them, what's your value proposition? They don't know. Or, we have the fastest machines in town. I'm sorry, that's not a value proposition. So, you have to, as a salesperson, you have very little control over this. But you have to know where you are and do the best you can to move from left to right. So what does that look like? So, in the middle, you've got perspective. You can bring ideas, you can make helpful suggestions, you can ask good questions. Those are all valuable. That's where the value of your experience plays in. But where you really want to be is that, particularly when a client is in trouble or struggling, you want to have specific lift recommendations or points of view that can have an immediate impact. Because we've noticed this over a period of years, when companies are making capital budgeting decisions, the period of time over which they're looking for payback is shrunk. And my understanding is, in most industries, it's less than a year. Any capital investment, they're looking for a return in less than a year. Now, you know, if you're an aluminum plant, that's not quite the same. But it's a very short time period. And so it's like, yeah, I understand about the long term, but you got to give me something that's going to produce an impact this quarter, whether it's training or a software investment or a hardware investment. So you have little control other than to harangue your product managers or product development people to give you something that's going to have an immediate impact. But going back to your point, John, if your company has little to offer or it's not really packaged as an immediate lift, then you really are left to the value of your own experience, and it becomes particularly important to be able to express that.
Well, you could flip the thinking here, too, from the customer's perspective and say, if we're making a decision and our decision criteria were what's the value of the salesperson who's representing their firm to us, what's the value of the firm itself, and what's the value of the solution or offer that they're making, that could then become their matrix for deciding who gets the business. But I want to go back to that first one where you said the value of the salesperson themselves. One of our other alliance partners, HR Chally, conducts the research each year on world-class sales organizations. And one of the questions they ask in that survey is, how do customers choose vendors or people that provide them with services or products? And they give them four categories: price, quality, the solution itself, or the salesperson. So as you might imagine, the punchline here is that price only comes up about 18% of the time. Quality is like 21, 22%. The solution itself is 20%. But 39% of the weighted decision criteria is on the salesperson themselves. So, yeah, kind of proves your point that that's a very key element there. So if I'm doing this little account plan that we talked about in this webinar, I've now got the client's view of their reality, where they're at in those three buckets, how they see me, distant vendor to true, someone that can give them lift, as you said, and then these three value pieces. What value do I bring to the account? What value does the firm bring? What value does my offer bring? What do we do now in our plan?
So yes to that, and I'm just reflecting, my company's in the process of selecting a new accounting firm, and if I'm thinking about how I'm making that decision of the firm, the first is who's working on the account with us. The second is, what's your process for working with your clients? Do you have real-time web portal? Do you have this? Do you have that? Do you have the other thing? So that's the company piece, and their processes. And the third is really the product. Everybody, you know, any competent CPA can provide the product. The question is, how's their process for working with their clients different, and what's the experience of the person I get? And, you know, I've got a pretty clear view about what that person needs to bring to the table to be helpful with me, and if somebody doesn't have that, it doesn't matter what the other stuff is. So it really is the salesperson that they look to, and it could be a team, but you still have to express the value of the team. You know, what's the difference between, you know, John, who's got 30 years in this business and has seen everything from, the onset of the basic computer language to where we are now. He's seen everything, and somebody who's just come right out of school. Well, it kind of depends on what problem you're trying to solve for your client. And that's why understanding where your clients are is so important. The value proposition may need to change. Should we go on?
Let's do it.
So there was some research done by the conference board that we found pretty interesting. And the most important reason that or contributor to the perception of value and satisfaction in a relationship, according to their research, was that the vendor brought new things, would teach new ways, basically, to their clients. And so what does that mean? They would value vendors who bring ideas and who have the ability to change the basic processes of the company that they're working with as a client. So ultimately, this picture is designed to represent a group of people who are learning and processing together and drawing from the vendor's experience to learn about new ways to do things. So there are a number of steps to that. One is to help the client compare themselves to others through some sort of benchmarking process. So if you're offering a hardware and software solution that performs better in particular tasks than others, you know, sometimes that data is readily available, sometimes it isn't, but it's useful to help your client understand where do you stand in terms of your current methodology, what's the gap to put you at the top of the heap in terms of where we see world-class or most effective having that data or the experience to comment on that is an important step toward teaching somebody new ways. It creates a vacuum or a gap, a desire to improve. It's really useful to be able to benchmark. And in the industry we're in, having that kind of data is really critical. And it is critical in IT and some others as well. The second step is to help the client interpret competitors. So I get a call last night from a line of business head at one of our clients who says, we're trying to take this kind of strategy. What do you see going on in the marketplace? Here's what we're trying to do. What do you see going on in the marketplace? I'm listening to his strategy, and I'm thinking, that's dead on arrival. That just is not going to work. I know their organization. That is not going to work. So my way of helping him see that was to compare where they are versus their competitors. So I'm not benchmarking performance data at this point. I'm benchmarking competitors and helping him to see this is who you're competing with. This is how they're doing it. This is the likely impact of your strategy. Here are some holes, because I see those too. So that helps Jeff, in this case, think about new ways, because his next question is, so what do you think I can do? Well, that's articulate options. Well, Jeff, you got two or three options here, and it's going to vary by market depending on who you're competing with, and here are the kinds of options that I see you have, A, B, C. And then his next question, and I'm not making this up, was, well, how would you do that? So that's where I get to share new approaches. All right, Jeff, so here's the deal. Nobody's doing strategy X, which has to do with a call center in this case. They're not doing that. It's been tried. People have pulled out of the market. We see it as a big hole. Here's how you would do that. This is roughly what it's going to cost you to do that internally, and here's what the outside buy is likely to be, and here are the steps you would need to take to get that started. Great. When can you come and see me? I'd like to talk more about this. So in that particular case, I've gone from, hi, you know, nice to chat with you, see you at the conferences every year, the industry conferences, to, I've got an invitation, I'd really like to work with you on this. And that started with me calling Jeff and saying, I understand you're working on this particular problem. I got some data you may find useful to compare yourself to others. And I went right through the sequence with him in two phone calls. So you can extend that. We will, if we get the engagement, bring new ways to that organization and help them learn and grow and interpret some things differently. We see that as a process that's applicable elsewhere. Again, you have a better shot at it if you're at senior levels of the organization than you're at, if you're at the complete execution level. But you can teach any person in an organization new ways to look at things. And we live in a culture that values growth and knowledge and growing and development. You know, if you see yourself as an educational institution as well as a vendor of whatever products that you're selling, you're going to be in a better position than those who just see themselves as vending the products. John, I know you have a lot of experience in industries that really rely heavily on information and knowledge. How would what I just said match up against the companies that you know best?
You know, to me, it's sort of a stretch as I hear you talking about this. I know you're sort of second nature to the idea of understanding business. You've been studying the industry that you serve predominantly for many years. You've got an MBA from University of Chicago. Your nature is to do this. But I would say financial literacy and business acumen skills are the things that we hear most often in our clients today that seems to be lacking, or I guess it's the biggest stretch for their salespeople, their ability to do this kind of thing well.
Yeah. There's an interesting thing that I notice about that. Amazingly, we notice that in our industry, the one we focus on the most as well. It's a pretty universal problem. And one of the things that we've noticed about not all high performers, but I would say a large enough percentage of them that I'd really notice it, is that the ones that consistently do well over time have a high commitment to their own personal development. And that's distinguishable from others who wait to be fed. So they'll go to the company training programs, they'll, you know, do their, you know, multitask their way through that, they'll do the minimum amount of reading, they'll whatever. That can be middle level performers as well, but the high performers really go after it and are constantly looking for new information and ways of looking at things. And I don't think you have to have the MBA or the other credentials that I personally have had to be curious. And I think that's, to a large extent, what it really comes down to. If you call on six companies in a particular industry, you've now developed a perspective that other people who are running those companies may not have. And you're able, whether you can do it completely quantitatively or not, to compare companies to each other, to see differences in their strategies and execution plans, to begin to interpret what they're doing from a competitive environment. You know, I don't buy that you have to be an MBA to do this, and I don't buy that you have to be financially literate to do it. Go find somebody in your company who is financially literate and ask for their help. It's really sounding really edgy here, I think. It's really, do you want it? Do you want to know? Do you want to go after it? Do you want to play with the big boys here and big girls and really provide value to your clients? And for the most part, the salespeople that we've seen inside and outside the financial services industry, most of them don't. They just want to do the job and go home. Well,
yeah, it's got to almost be an intellectual curiosity kind of thing that drives you to want to do that thing.
Or just hungry. You want the money. So what do I have to do to get the money? Well, I have to be able to bring some value to my clients. Where does value live? Well, I have to be able to do some things for them that aren't in my company's playbook or product manual. Okay, where do I get that? Which is one of the reasons, frankly, why I admire and you know, companies that really are serious about this in their hiring process. And this takes you right back to the HR challenge. Are you hiring people who are competitive? Are you hiring people who are curious? Are you hiring people who just demand the resources that they need to get moving and get their clients moving? And there are a ton of companies out there that don't use the resources that are available to hire people who will do that for them. To me, a lot of this is a hiring decision. It's not a training decision. It's not even a management and compensation decision. It's a hiring decision.
To that, I will say amen. Should we push to the next slide?
Push on. Pay more attention to how you sell. So the short version of this is it's not just about giving them a result. It's about giving them a good ride or a good experience. And the them, in this case, being your clients. The idea of being part of an experience-based economy is a few years old now. Joe Pine wrote a book called The Experienced Economy. There are others that have come out. And as we get deeper and deeper into the information age, this idea of the client experience seems to be more and more important. People point to the Ritz-Carlton as a good example of a company that uses information both aggressively and effectively to manage the client experience of their guests. There have been several articles written about them. They collect data about I can't even tell you how many fields they collect, but they collect, and everybody is in the organization, from the concierge desk to the bell stand to the front desk to the sales office, is responsible for contributing data about what's going on in the hotel. And they've developed software that crunch all this together. The reason it looks so effortless in the front is because of all this work they're doing at the back. And now, an individual salesperson isn't going to be able to do that. That's a corporate strategy issue. But the idea is, if your company has a brand, then this path that you see here, this path to a sales result, has to exemplify the brand. So something a salesperson really needs to understand is, what is the company brand? What are our values? What is the experience we're trying to give our clients? If we say that we are a company that's about advising clients on money, for example, what's our process for giving people confidence that we're actually doing that well? That's part of the sales process. Here, we have a bank, for example, that wanted to capture a significant amount of share, and they went out and looked at their customers who had investment assets in some in their bank and some in other banks, and asked the question, what would it take to get people to consolidate? Defined a completely new sales process, including defining details down to how long the clients would be left sitting in the waiting area before they would see their advisor, and what documents were left there for them to read, and how the advisor on meeting this customer would integrate those documents into the conversation. Playbook, step by step by step. Far more than most companies are going to do. But the point of this is, if you're a sales manager or a marketing manager, as opposed to an individual sales rep, you need to think about how what your salespeople are doing, how that represents your brand and your company's values, and to think about how each step in the sales process has value for the client. How does a proposal have a value for a client? A lot of proposals are written apparently without even considering that thought. It's all about the vending company, not about the client. How is a sales call a value for the client? Well, most salespeople see it as a value for the vending organization. I got to get information about this client so I can propose a solution and get on to the next client. Well, there's no value in that for the client. John, you mentioned in an earlier conversation Neil Rackham's point about asking a client, would you have paid for that sales call? Well, that's what we're talking about here is each step in the process, and certainly each step I do as a sales rep, I need to be asking myself the question, does it generate value for my client? Did I make a difference in their day or their week by being there for that meeting? And then moving on from that, what am I doing in the organization? You know, we've all had the experience of getting lucky and being able to sell at the top of the house and then having an initiative fail because the rest of the house wasn't lined up to support it. You know, in my case, that happened 25 years ago. I refer to it as the $250,000 sure thing because I got the vice chairman of a very large company to say, yep, we're going to do this. That's great. Send me a contract. And I did. Project was over 6 weeks later. Why was that? Because the division managers weren't bought in. I'd made a huge mistake, one that I haven't made again since. Got to have all the players lined up. And so part of your role as a salesperson in this kind of environment, particularly where it's very challenging, is I've got to make sure I'm building broad internal support and agreement for whatever it is I'm going to propose at the top of the house, because the top of the house is going to say, is everybody lined up? They're going to ask their own people, are you behind this? And if their answer is, well, we really haven't considered it, your proposal isn't going anywhere. So how you sell, meaning broad internal support, is a really critical element of this, and it seems to be larger and larger as more and more people have access to information and as consensus as a style of management continues to be important. And to remember that it's not just about the results, as I said before. How is it to deal with you individually? What do you like to deal with? Do you leave people with a good taste in your mouth? Do they say, that was great she was in. I really love it when she comes. You know, we always have a good time. She brings great points. She always follows up. I mean, I really feel well taken care of when she's calling on us, just as an example. Do you pay attention to that? Or are you just executing some process you learned in the sales training program? Yeah, I got to send a follow-up note. Okay, dear Bob, it's great meeting with you. I'll follow up immediately. It's great that you sent the follow-up note. What does that note look like? What color ink did you use? How's your printing or your writing? What does that say about you? Those are all details that a salesperson can consider. I'm at a very micro level there. But you have to be, as an individual salesperson, thinking about what joy and educational value and other elements am I going to bring to this client when I call on them besides, yeah, I got to get some information so I can make a proposal. So, John, what do you think of as you hear that?
Well, I'm back to the whole thing. Would they pay for it? You know, was it a good enough experience that they thought it had the value that they would actually put money out for it? So, makes a lot of sense.
So, in our sales process, for example, we do view ourselves as an educational institution. I mean, we do that by writing, we do it by speaking, we do it in our sales calls by always bringing some market perspective. I mean, we have a process that we've laid out about how we like to educate our clients about what's going on in the market and what options they have available to them. Sometimes it takes a year or longer to get somebody to respond. Other times it's pretty quick. But what they typically say is, you know, I'm really glad you called this time. You've been sending me such great ideas, and I really haven't been in a position to respond to them, but now I am. And they pull out a folder in which they've got all the articles that we've sent them and say, I'd like to go over this one. So my company has a process to do that. defined in general terms, but it's our salespeople who execute that, and they decide which articles, and they decide the frequency, and they decide how all that happens. I don't, as the president. So even if your company doesn't provide any of those tools to you, if you see yourself in the business of helping people generate new ideas and move themselves along, you can pull articles from other sources or write your own. But this is just one example of thinking about what's the experience. And as the sales leader, you've got the problem of consistency. So, you know, I've got that. I've got a couple of salespeople. Those of you who work for larger organizations who have a couple of hundred or a couple of thousand salespeople, consistency counts. What your salespeople are doing is your brand. This is a slide of pictures of doors from Shropshire in England, and all these wonderful doors. They're all doors, and they're all in the same town, but they're very little consistency. So that's like having 200 salespeople. They're all salespeople. They all work for your company, but none of them do anything the same. You don't have a brand in the field. You've got 200 individual brands. I would have a problem with that if I were the CEO or you know, major shareholder in that company. So it's important, that balance between consistency and individual creativity is important, and if you want people to think, you have to give them some room to create. But this idea of the brand really lives in what your salespeople are doing. And if this is what your sales force looks like, or if this is you from call to call doing it differently every time, then you have a problem if your clients are thinking, who should we call on? Who should we call for help? You want to have a pretty consistent message. And if your salespeople and your service people and your implementation people are all carrying different messages into a single account, you got a problem. So this is a plea for, you got to, if you want to be recognized and called out, particularly during rough times, you have to have a clean, consistent, clearly understood message, and everything you do with that client needs to represent that message. John?
Good picture. Love the metaphor. I'm back to the account plan that everyone hopefully has been working on. You've gone through your process of identifying where your customer's at, how they perceive you in the relationship, the three buckets of value you're going to consider, and then what new ways you're going to teach as you move along, then thinking about your process and how it adds value. This also reminds me of that old maxim that you and I have discussed many times, Nick, about we have to give credit to the author here, Charlie Platypotis. You remember he was probably one of the best sales pros I ever knew. You remember what he used to say about this concept of a network inside the organization?
I do.
Which was?
There isn't anyone inside an account you don't want to meet.
Yeah.
Or words to that effect.
I used to walk into accounts with him. I thought he worked there. I mean, the way it, you would have thought that he was just showing up for work as opposed to a sales guy coming into the account. So, all good stuff. Well, let's talk. We've got a few minutes left. I'd like to talk about some next steps, but before we do that, maybe some Q&A from our participants. If you want to unmute the lines, I think you have to toggle through a few of those star sevens.
Yep, I think we're all in conversation mode now.
Great. Maybe I could just test. Desiree, can you hear us? Maybe not.
Maybe not.
Carol Bunn, can you hear us?
I can, John.
Great. Okay, so we've got the audience back. We've got Nick for a few more minutes here. Is there anything anyone would like to ask Nick while we have him on the line?
Hello, Nick. This is Steve. I know that your primary focus is on the financial industry. For someone who focuses on multiple industries, would you have two or three recommendations on ways that they could best stay abreast of marketplace and competitive information for multiple industries?
Pick one industry. You know, it's an interesting question. So one part of the answer there is, what are your information sources, and are you set up with resources like First Research or others that track industries and give information? So that's one thing. Do you have an information base that would allow you efficiently to understand what's going on in particular industries? First Research happens to be a particularly good one, but there are others around. Second is, you can't swallow the elephant at one time if you wanted to swallow an elephant. So the idea is that I learned from actually one of our Advantage colleagues was pick one industry and maybe even within that pick one particular set of challenges, master that, and then move on to the next one so that you're building over time. And what I've seen people do is focus on a particular challenge like hiring or negotiating, you know, contracts or project management or whatever it happens to be, and carry that expertise across multiple industries as a starting point, be expertise-based, and then build the understanding of the industries. I think you have to pick either the industry or the solution set as the starting point.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Thanks for the question. Which, by the way, in our industry, financial services, you've got salespeople who might be calling on 30 different industries instead of four or five. But when it's 30, what I just said becomes particularly important. You have to have a focus point to help you there.
Right.
Anybody else have a question? Happy to answer.
Nick, I would build on your last comment, too, for Steve to suggest functional knowledge. Sometimes functional knowledge across a broad industry segment is of great value as well. So if you're an expert in human resources or IT or, shipping, whatever it is, I think that translates pretty well, too. So let's keep our commitment to time here. Nick, we have some things that we can offer people next through your Advantage partner. If you'd like to get a copy of these slides, you're more than welcome to them, and we'll make those available to all the Advantage partners so that they can get them to you. If you'd like some personal consultation with Nick, he's offering that on the phone at no charge. If you'd like to talk more about these ideas and how you can bring them to your sales teams, or he'd be prepared to run this webinar internally for your sales teams or your training group to help you sharpen the saw. And then I mentioned the weekly Sales Thought newsletter. Highly encourage all of you to consider. You can get that at www.clarityadvantage.com. And there's also Clarity webinars that you can join as well. Finally, Nick, I think just some contact information. If you do not know who your Advantage partner is, you can contact me. That's my cell phone number there and my address for additional information. And I'd like to thank Nick for providing clarity today. Nick, I got the picture of why you named your firm Clarity. You gave us great clarity about how to behave more professionally as salespeople, bring more value to our customers, and hopefully plan better strategies to get better relationships faster. So thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome.
All righty. Make it a great day.
All right. Thanks, Nick.
Bye-bye.
Welcome. Bye-bye.